Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear about the latest exhibit at Gilcrease Museum devoted to an American Indian artist who influenced a generation of contemporary artists despite his tragic death in a car accident at the age of 31. T.C. Cannon was born and raised in southwestern Oklahoma, son of a Kiowa father and Caddo mother. Within 2 years of his enrolling in the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe back in 1964, he was creating acclaimed work by critics and audiences alike, utilizing vivid colors that invited discussion on Indian cultural heritage and the social and political winds of the 1960s and 70s. His work fused the traditional painting subjects of Native American art at that time with the color palette and look of artists like Vincent van Gogh or Henri Matisse or Edouard Vuillard in massive paintings, of which over 30 are featured in the retrospective exhibit T.C. Cannon at the Edge of America, currently on display at Gilcrease. The exhibit not only features over 90 complete works by the artist, but his music and poetry as well. Joining me today to discuss his work is the exhibition curator, Karen Kramer. She is the curator of Native American and Oceanic Art and Culture at the Peabody Essex Museum, and she joins us today on Studio Tulsa. T.C. Cannon at the Edge of America is on display at Gilcrease Museum now through October 7th. Karen Kramer, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
I am so looking forward to seeing this T.C. Cannon show because he's an artist that I wasn't familiar with the name, but once I saw some of his artwork, it was like, this seems very, very familiar. And in many ways, he is absolutely an artist of his time. Unfortunately, a very short life, but an amazing artist that was reflecting not only an awakening of his own cultural heritage at a time when Indians were celebrating their Indianness, but also of the overall turbulent times of the 1960s and early 1970s. What was the inspiration for you getting involved with this show?
Well, I think for me, T.C. Cannon's work speaks so relevantly to America today. And we are still grappling with so many of these issues that Cannon was working through on canvas, in his poetry, in his music. And so for me, it was really a bullseye in terms of finding the most compelling contemporary Native artist and one of the most inventive 20th century American artists and tying it to today.
And I think that's the most important thing you said. You know, we think of Indian art as in this genre, and they are American artists. And certainly he was an American artist first and foremost, even though he was painting exclusively Indian themes.
That's right. I think Cannon, we cannot divorce and we do not want to divorce his amazing, rich Native background and worldview from his creative output. But he also wanted to be understood as an artist first and foremost. And he was engaging in painting techniques that transcend time and space and culture.
You said as you began thinking about doing a show about him, you're saying, I was thinking about how his art is relevant today. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, okay, as you're putting this exhibit together, you know, you're seeing what's happening at Standing Rock and the like. Was that in the forefront of your thoughts or is it more base questions about Native American identity?
A little more base questions about social justice issues and seeing American history through a Native perspective and telling truth and truths about American history from an indigenous perspective that had been completely missing from the annals of American history and American art history until T.C. Cannon really found his voice and came onto the scene. I think the Standing Rock came a little bit later, and then Trump was elected, and everything has shifted since then. And right as we were starting to do the interpretation for the show, we all said, we've got to buckle our seatbelts. We do not know what this landscape's going to be like, even in a couple more months. So
really,
it's been an adventure.
Yeah. What really strikes me about his art is this vibrant color that he's using. It's very much, you know, if you look at any of the art of the 1960s, it was all about color, color, color. And certainly it's reflected in his art. But when you think of Western art at that particular time, color was not all that big at that particular point. It was more, muted colors, I think, when I think of Western art at that particular time.
Yes, I think one of the most exciting things about TC's palette is this bold, dynamic, vibrant color, but also the choices that he made and why he may have chosen to paint his warrior with a purple pompadour instead of brown hair, really going for the unexpected.
Do you think he was influenced by Fauvism? You know, when you think, I mean, Fauvism from the early 1900s, where these French artists would take these French landscapes and all of a sudden, instead of having blue water, it was purple water or orange water or something like that.
Yes, he was absolutely influenced by the Fauvists. And I think how he painted was also quite Fauvist in his techniques. He painted in this really flat manner, but his color choices, these complementary color choices, really become electric when he would put purple and orange together. And he was wild about Matisse and Van Gogh and other Fauvists and post-impressionist painters.
Now, he grew up in Western Oklahoma,
yes.
A Kiowa Caddo artist. Kiowa, probably foremost at his heritage, I think. Was he all in tune with the Kiowa Six and that school of American Indian art?
Yes, absolutely. T.C. Cannon was enrolled as a Caddo member until, I think, his early 20s, and then he changed enrollment. I think he changed his enrollment to be Kiowa. And he would have been very familiar with the Kiowa Six. He went to St. Patrick's School in Anadarko, and he would have been familiar with Kiowa Six murals that were on the Anadarko post office walls, and I think he grew up. In fact, some of the earliest works in the exhibition date between 1960 and 1963, and they really are emulating the Kiowa Six dancers and sort of flat pencil on paper, and they're sort of ritual dancers, and there's definitely a connection there.
Of course, he went to school at the Institute of American Indian Arts out in Santa Fe in 1964, and this is when you think about what was happening in the 1960s at Santa Fe, this was one of these major melting pots, like, you know, the suburbs of Paris in the 1870s, where all these artists came together and all of them were influencing one another. I assume this was what really made T.C. Cannon's art what it is.
That's right. I think it was an explosion of creativity, and the students were really encouraged to stretch themselves, learn from each other. It was almost like, I've heard it talked about as this almost like an experimental think tank, where people would groove on ideas and learn from each other, and they had access to all kinds of art magazines from beyond the United States, but including American art in the United States, all kinds of supplies and materials, and they were just going for it.
In a culture where they were empowered.
That's right.
As opposed to many other places where they might have come from, where they were treated as second-class citizens, or at least because of the circumstances of where they were lived, it was assumed they were second-class citizens.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things to remember, too, about the IAIA at that time. And number one is that the philosophy of the school was a celebration and a harnessing of that creative cultural energy. And there were, when TC was a student, his peers were from over 87 different tribal nations from the United States and Canada. And so it was this marriage of cultural heritage, politics of the day, art of the day, music of the day. But the other thing is that the IAIA was a school under the Bureau of
Indian Affairs?
Yeah, the BIA, that's right. Uh-huh. And so a lot of the students still felt like subjects of the government. And at the time, there was barbed wire around the campus. And so
really?
I think there's a myth and there's a reality. And somewhere in there is what actually happened in this amazing explosion.
So this was like a counterculture with it.
Yeah, I think so.
So how vastly did his art change once he went to Santa Fe? Did it change greatly?
It did change greatly. It did. And he found his visual language fairly quickly at the Institute of American Indian Arts. And he started playing with materials that he had never experimented with to this degree. He was painting giant oil paintings on canvas and acrylic, and he was also experimenting with bold color and really exploring the relationship between native and non-native elements and these mashups. That's sort of where his magic was founded.
When you actually go through the exhibition, I think one of the earlier of the large canvases that are there is one from probably when he was at IAIA, and that would be Mama and Papa Have the Going Home Shiprock Blues.
Yes.
Which is utterly a 60s title. You can see this influence of music and everything going into this title. And yet this, and it's really interesting because I always thought of Fritz Scholder as being one of the first artists to portray Native Americans in sort of a culture in which they were living, you know, in the 60s and 70s, not as some idealized or culture. Yet here is T.C. Cannon doing this couple waiting, obviously, for the bus to take them home. And it's this mix of erudite figures, again, with these mod colors, these very, very bright palette. And it's just a really striking image.
Yes, and it does predate Fritz Scholder's Super Indian series that dates to 1967. And that painting that you're talking about is really the painting that spurred the new Indian art movement of the 60s. And it is among Cannon's most important early work, if not the most important student work that he did. And we're so lucky and grateful to have it in the exhibition. And one thing that's really great about that is in 1967, we have a recording of Cannon singing a companion song that he wrote in conjunction with that painting, and he recorded it just a couple weeks before he left for boot camp and then Vietnam. And so for Cannon, music, poetry, and painting were inseparable, and we see that really come together in that trio.
And I think some other commenters have talked about the way the man in the painting is holding his cigarette. It's almost like some artsy...
There's a little swagger to that. Yeah.
Isn't it?
It's wonderful. It's wonderful. And she's got her sunglasses on that are so cool. And they're sort of suspended in time. And you don't know if they're coming or going or if it's then and now because of all these mashups of time and culture and place.
What was the reaction to that painting at the time? Did people see that as something utterly different? And was it sort of a hit from the very first day?
It absolutely was. I think it was chosen to be a part of a traveling exhibition that toured Europe, and that painting has seen a lot. It was a part of T.C. Cannon and Fritz Scholder's big breakthrough exhibition for T.C. in Washington, D.C. in 1972, Two American Painters. And so that painting has seen a lot, and I think people from the very beginning recognized Cannon as this incredible talent and saw part of themselves in that painting, his peers, and I think the audience who saw it really understood it to be as important as it has become.
As you go through the galleries, you're going to see all these very traditional foreground portraits.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, except the colors are, you know, these vibrant colors as opposed to maybe what are realistic colors. But the backgrounds are crazy colors. They're purple backgrounds with little circles like wallpapered contemporary homes or, you know, he was just working in a completely different way.
Absolutely. I think that the background foreground interplay was another one of Cannon's techniques and ways of telling stories, and the wallpapers that he set his figures inside these interiors are just psychedelic and wild. And T.C. Cannon had lots of books on Victorian furniture and Victorian art and lots of art history books, and so he was studying wallpapers, but he was also creating his own wallpapers because one of his favored leitmotifs was the circle within a circle that for him symbolized renewal and healing. So if you think about that, kind of penetrating that space that one of his warriors is sitting in front of, it's this really active message of resilience and being in the world.
Now, the other thing the exhibit does is also this, you know, this artist was not only painting, but he was writing poetry. He was composing music. He was utterly consumed with the music of Bob Dylan and some others. you know, a man of his time, really, in many ways, hearing the messages in the music and reflecting that in his art and reflecting in his own art of writing poetry and music. Do you feature that in the show?
Yes, we do. There are approximately 10 poems that you'll see in the exhibition that have been reproduced on the wall, almost as large as some of his largest paintings, in order to sort of elevate that art form and really understand that it was just as important to canon as painting was. And same with music. He couldn't have been a painter or a poet without the music. It shaped all that he did. And so within the exhibition, we've got one of Cannon's early recordings, but then we also commissioned an Oklahoma-based epic singer-songwriter, Samantha Crane, who is Choctaw and has been in love with T.C. Cannon's work for a long time. And we commissioned her to put music to one of T.C. Cannon's poems that's a companion to a work of art. And then we also, this was one of the highlights of the project, we flew Samantha up to Seattle to create her own song and lyrics for the 22-foot mural that's in the exhibition. And so we have her singing her own homage to T.C. Cannon's amazing mural, and we have a video in the exhibition of the sort of making of the song. Yeah, it's a really special experience.
So it sounds like the Peabody Essex Museum, when you're putting this together, you really wanted to make this a really sort of almost a reawakening of this artist's work. Because of his short life, I think maybe he's forgotten a little bit.
I think that we wanted to celebrate his vision and voice in a way that hasn't been done with the paintings, poetry, and music. And I don't think that people have forgotten about Cannon, but he's gone largely unrecognized in the mainstream, in part because so many of his paintings are in private hands. And so the last big exhibition that was done was in 1990 through the then National Cowboy Hall of Fame, and that traveled to the Idle Jorg Museum. And Joan Frederick did a great book in 1995. He stood in the sun. But really, we wanted to celebrate the entirety of Cannon's creative output in a way that hasn't been done, and in order to put him on the map of American art and celebrate him as an American artist and a Native American artist.
My guest today is Karen Kramer, the exhibition curator for T.C. Cannon at the Edge of America, which is now on display at Gilcrease Museum through October 7th. She's the curator of Native American and Oceanic Art and Culture at the Peabody Essex Museum, where the exhibition originated. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, I was going to ask you about, with so many of his paintings in private hands, how difficult was this to collect the work, to put it together, a retrospective?
Yes, that's a great question. I would say some of the work was already done for us in a way, because Joan Frederick's wonderful He Stood in the Sun book had the names of many of the collectors. We were also connected to several gallery owners in Santa Fe and New York. So through talking with Joyce, T.C. Cannon's sister, and Joan Frederick, and some of T.C. Cannon's student peers and artist friends and family, they would lead me to another person who would lead me to another person. But I also have to say, having a savvy, hungry millennial working on your project is the way to go, because our assistant curator, who is helping out on this project, really tracked people down. And, you know, Facebook, Instagram, Google, like every way possible, we were trying to reach people that, or sisters of brothers of cousins of people who have T.C. Cannon's work.
Now, were the collectors reluctant to part with the work, or were they more likely to want to show it, because if it gets known, then the value of the work goes up?
Well, I think that the collectors are very reluctant to let their babies leave their house for as long as they have. We are blessed to have incredibly generous lenders who are lending the material for up to 2 years. But at the same time, for them, it was about the mission of the project and getting on board and getting people to get to know T.C. Cannon. And perhaps there is something to do with the value increasing, but I think for them, it was a mission of the heart. It was really, they were on board.
I love this painting, and I want people to know about it.
I love this artist, and people need to know about him. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about some of the pieces that are in there. There's so many highlights. One that I think people will immediately be taken to is The Cloud Madonna from 1975. Again, it's a very traditional image in the foreground, again, set against this crazy purple backdrop.
Yes. He painted that when he was an artist in residence at Dartmouth College over the summer of 1975. And he was working off of black and white photographs taken of women and one woman in particular at Santa Clara Pueblo. And just recently, a Santa Clara Pueblo artist, Jason Garcia, brought these photographs to my attention because previously scholars have attributed Cannon's Cloud Madonna as being inspired by Curtis photographs of women at Acoma and Zuni Pueblos. And a lot of times he was working off of 19th and early 20th century historic romanticized Edward S. Curtis photographs, for example. But in this case, it's a different photographer, and it's this amazing close crop of this beautiful woman wearing a blue mantle and just like religious Christian Madonnas, she's carrying something precious, but instead of a baby, she's carrying this life-sustaining melon. And she has a water jar on top of her head that sort of serves as a halo.
Right, right. It's really, really a brilliant picture, I think. Another one which caught my eye was this one called Abi Abakabi.
Yes.
And what I was really struck by was when you look at the background, you can see he's very much influenced by French painting from the late 19th century, early 20th century. And the background looks just like Van Gogh's wheat fields.
It absolutely does. And he was a huge fan of Van Gogh. That painting is being lent to us from the Fred Jones Museum in Norman, Oklahoma. So we're grateful to have that. And it is said to be among the last paintings he ever created and also was said to be on his easel at the time of his death. So if you look closely, the space under her feet isn't complete. And then the sky, the horizon line is really high on that painting and there aren't any clouds. And there are so many clouds. Like clouds are this amazing touchstone in Cannon's work, and there are no clouds. So I have to think that perhaps he was going to paint some, maybe. I don't know. But yes, the crosshatching on the background is incredible, and it really does hearken to a Van Gogh-like treatment.
Now, when he was doing his large paintings, and there are 30 major paintings in the show, some of them, when you look at them, they're done over several year periods. Was he one of these artists that would work on it for a while, come back to it till it was completely finished in his view?
Yes, that's right. He was working slowly at times, but he often would rework a painting later. So the big canvas, Two Guns Aricara, he started in 1973, but he reworked it again in 1977. And some of this we didn't find out until we were actually hanging the exhibition because we got to see the backs of the canvases, which you couldn't see when it's hanging on the private collector's wall above their piano. So we were able to sort of augment our knowledge of when Cannon was working and how he was working. So in 1977, he went back in and painted the warrior's shirt in oil.
Yeah. What's really interesting to me, one of the things that's interesting about this artist, which was a revelation, was that, you know, his first big break, which is, I believe it was an exhibition that toured Europe, and it was of Southwestern Plains artists, and he was in Vietnam.
Yeah.
When that happened. And of course, he died tragically in an automobile accident before his first big solo New York show. I mean, it's in many ways a tragic figure.
Yeah, I think the fact that he was also a soldier is part of the story that we're trying to tell in T.C. Cannon at the Edge of America, and the fact that he really did, like, what would have become of T.C. Cannon had he lived longer. It's this bittersweet, tragic story because his work is so good. And he was creating incredible works before he was really,
late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah. Mama and Papa, that painting, he did that when he was 20. So it's really amazing to walk through the gallery and think about how young he was when he was doing all this.
We have to talk about the huge mural that is a part of this show, Epics in Plains History, Mother Earth, Father Son, the Children Themselves. This is a huge, huge canvas mural, really, and really is an amazing piece of work. Tell us a little bit about this piece.
Okay, well, this is a 22-foot wide mural that was commissioned by the city of Seattle, and he completed this between 1976 and 1977, and it tells, according to canon, and his words are in the exhibition, it tells the story of Plains Indian history starting from the beginning of time to the very present, which would have been 1977 when he finished. And so you see this epic sweep through time. And you see a clan of what he calls the old people in the left-hand side of the screen, mm-hmm. on the left-hand side of the painting. And he brings you through the very present with a contemporary gourd dancer literally stepping off of the canvas on the right-hand side.
Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful work. Again, yes. With these vibrant colors. But you could see his palette sort of maturing with that work, I think, in a way.
Yeah. And he talked about it as almost like a cinematic approach, which was very different for him, because if you think about the single figure portraits that he was making as almost like a single cell of a comic book or something like that, and then here's this really wide 22-foot canvas that he was working on, he can tell a story in a very different way. So we've got ledger painting references in there. We've got gifts from Mother Earth of the buffalo, the white buffalo, and there's just so much going on there. So he does use color and story in a very different way.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk with you about T.C. Cannon at the Edge of America, which is on display at Gilcrease Museum. You know, with so many of these large canvases, I know you have some works on paper and some small works too. Is there a small work we should maybe check out, because I think you can get overwhelmed by the large scale, large paintings. Is there a little small work that we should be looking
for? Oh, sure. Well, I'd recommend a couple different small works, if I may. One is what is T.C. Cannon's earliest portrait and play with wallpaper behind the portrait, and that dates to 1966. And there's also a sketchbook from his student years at the Institute from 1965, and there's a reproduction of that, so you can flip through that and see how he was working on songs, playing with the figure, positive and negative space, composition. He was writing down homework assignments, people's phone numbers, so it's really fun.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like a great exhibit, and it sounds like it was a lot of fun working on, too.
It was the biggest joy and greatest privilege to date, yes.
Well, Karen Kramer, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Karen Kramer is the curator of Native American and Oceanic Art and Culture at the Peabody Essex Museum and the exhibition curator for T.C. Cannon at the Edge of America, which is currently on display at Gilcrease Museum through October 7th. For more information and a look at T.C. Cannon's art, you can visit gilcrease.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.